Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. One of the biggest science stories of the year came from right here in New Hampshire, the creation of a new research and production facility that will create human tissues and organs. Officially, it's called ARMI, which stands for Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Institute, and it's located in Manchester's Mill Yard. The announcement was a huge headline in the science and tech world this year, but there were many others, including a cosmic crash called a kilonova and a lunar eclipse that had the whole country looking up. Today in The Exchange, the top science and tech stories of 2017, from outer space to the human body. Let's hear from you. What's your vote for the science headline of the year? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests for the hour. Dave Brooks is in studio, reporter for the Concord Monitor and blogger at Granite Geek. And Dave, it's always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
I'm always happy to be here.
Also joining us from D.C. is Macon Morehouse, news director for Science News, a daily website and biweekly magazine that focuses on science. And Macon, really nice to have you. Thank you for your time.
Also great to be here. Thanks.
Well, both of you, you know, it's obvious every year there are major developments in science and tech. Dave, to you first, how does this year compare in terms of the wow factor?
In terms of the wow factor, I guess I wasn't wowed as much as I may have been in some past years. As you mentioned, the ARMI, A-R-M-I, which we're going to talk about later, it was sort of the big news for New Hampshire, even though to a certain extent it's a technology and almost business process story more than a science story. But there was a pretty steady stream of interesting research coming out of universities, in particular in the state. And frequently, an awful lot of it had to do with climate change, which we'll also be talking about. So, but I don't think there was a single, you know, hit it out of the park story.
What do you think, Macon? Every year, you guys at Science News do a top 10 science stories of the year. How big a wow factor was there for you this year?
I think it was a mixed bag. The neutron star collision clearly was a huge wow. It's sort of a holy grail of space news. But and some of our other top stories were building on research from previous years, like gene editing, which we will also get to later. But the neutron star collision was a pretty big deal. And we've also had some recent climate news that we'll be talking about that also was pretty big. But I think the rest of it was just what science is, which is a build of research until it gets to a certain critical moment where there are breakthroughs.
Well, let's talk about the kilonova then, because we had some astronomers on earlier when this happened, and they were absolutely gaga over this story. So a lot of listeners maybe caught that show, but just in case they didn't, Macon, just remind us, what's a kilonova or a neutron explosion?
Okay, so what we had is two neutron stars which collided and sent these with gravitational waves or ripples in space-time out through space, and we have gravitational wave detectors on Earth now, and we had actually three of them up and running, and they caught this signal, and the signal is pretty amazing because it's tiny. It's like a fraction of the size of a proton, but these machines are so delicate they can pick them up. The cool thing about this is with three detectors running, they were able to triangulate where the signal was coming from and point all these telescopes at it. And they were able to catch light from the collision, which just gave an incredible wealth of information. And this, it just was a lot of firsts. It was the first neutron star collision ever detected. They got evidence for the first time that these collisions, the coolest thing I think is that these collisions make all these heavy elements, including gold, silver, platinum, uranium. You know, one of the scientists that we talked to just had this really cool quote that he was like, wow, my wedding ring came from a neutron star collision. So it's pretty neat.
Yeah, there were people saying, you know, from your wedding ring to all the gold that Pharaoh ever collected, you know, came from this. And from what I understand, Macon, it was the first time scientists got both the sound and the light show, right? I mean, yeah, go ahead. Did that make it different?
Yeah, so it was the first time they caught both gravitational waves and the whole spectrum of light. So putting those two things together just opened up a whole new way of looking at the sky and determining what was going on. You know, they're going to need a lot more detections to really nail down some of these things, like to determine if neutron star collisions are the place where heavy elements come from. Just they need to figure out if it can account for all the heavy elements that we know about. But it's an amazing, amazing start.
Go ahead, Dave.
What I like about it actually is it's a reminder of the fact that, you know, you and I and everything we have here on this rocky planet were produced from the inside of stars in various ways. Neutron star collision is different than a lot of it, but, you know, I'm a baby boomer, grew up with the songs about, you know, we are stardust, but we really are stardust. And this was a perfect example of it.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And another thing that the scientists we talked to were super excited about was that this kilonova was a discovery that, as they put it, vanquished some theories and vindicated others. I want to play a little clip of Vicky Calogero. She's an astrophysicist at Northwestern University on the kilonova. And here she is reiterating what a lot of people said, that this event beautifully validated the work of Albert Einstein. Let's hear.
What's amazing with this discovery is that theoretically, all of this that was observed on August 17th was actually predicted. So over a century ago, Einstein predicted that two orbiting objects will emit gravitational waves.
So that's Vicky Calogero, again, astrophysicist. That clip, by the way, from an Al Jazeera news video. Could you talk about that a little bit, Macon, the idea that this discovery vanquished some theories and vindicated others?
Sure. So, you know, one of the theories, we've talked about the elements. One of the theories was neutron star collisions do make these heavy elements. So that was pretty clearly vindicated, very quickly. There have been a lot of questions about dark energy, which is this mysterious substance in the universe, and the collision was able to rule out some theories dealing with that. Another big issue is how fast is the universe expanding, and the collision didn't answer that, but it gave us a new measurement, which happens to be right smack in between two other ways we have of measuring how fast the universe is expanding. So it leaves that question open, but maybe helps to start narrow down what the real answer is.
Well, and you anticipate my next question, Macon. You know, we're looking at the top stories of 2017, but what from this kilonova will scientists be looking at in 2018? You started to allude to that there.
They are looking into, they have an immense, immense amount of data. They had telescopes from around the world zeroing in on this region and collecting data. There was just a paper that came out this week talking about how when the collision sent out this jet of material, they anticipated that the signal would be like a short burst, and apparently there's this afterglow that's kind of cocooning where the neutron star, the merged one, is now. And so they're trying to figure out what's going on with that because they've never seen anything like that before. So there is going to be a continuing parade of discoveries, and who knows what they're going to be, but there is a lot of data and a lot of people excited about it. I think at one point, what was it, something like 15% of all astronomers around the world have been involved in doing research on this. So I have to double check that. Yeah,
yeah, there were a lot of
all
them,
astronomers.
Basically.
It's unbelievable. I mean, that you just don't see those numbers all focused on one thing.
Yeah, and the collaborative aspect of it was something that I think warmed a lot of people, you know, that so many scientists from so many different countries and different backgrounds could get together on this thing. We're covering
exactly
the top science stories of 2017 today in the Exchange, science and tech, and we'd love to hear your votes for some of the top science and tech headlines that caught your attention this year. You can join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So another science headline regarding outer space, but much closer to home. And Dave Brooks, I'll turn to you first. The eclipse, going through the materials yesterday, looking at the top science stories of the year. This one was fun to look back at.
It was great.
It's a beautiful day. Go ahead.
It was what you would like a science story to be. It was everybody got together. Everybody's excited. I was down at the Discovery Center here in Concord when we came to as close as we did to the full eclipse. And there was several hundred people. I believe it was the largest crowd they'd ever had except for their opening day down there. And kids, little kids and big kids and old kids like me all running around and putting our heads inside of boxes so we could look at the shadows and putting on those goofy-looking glasses and staring at the sky. It brought everybody together in a way that not a lot of things do these days. In terms of science, there was a lot of interesting science done with it. But from my point of view, what was more important was it got the general public thinking about the fact that, you know, science can tell us what's going on in the world. Science can predict what's going to happen in ways that other things can't. And that it's just really fun to be part of it.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to watch it with a friend who is a elementary school science educator. So she had, you know, the strainers out and the colanders, and she had everything. So it was fun to experience it at that level. From what I understand, Dave, there are eclipses, I hope that's the right plural, all the time. Why did this one in particular get so much attention?
Just because it went through a lot of populated areas. You're right. They come, well, there's two every 3 years or something like that, depending on the patterns of the rotation of the moon around the Earth and relationship with the sun. And it just happens to be where they land. There's full eclipse in, there's other parts of the country, other parts of the world this year. And, of course, 2024, seven years now, we are going to have another one. It's going to be way up north. The actual the totality will just miss New Hampshire. It'll go just north of our border.
In Canada or in Maine?
Just in Canada.
Yeah.
In fact, I was looking up on the map. I'm going to have to go rent a yurt in San Isidore de Clifton. I bet I didn't pronounce that right.
So it's going to be way north.
It's going to be way north, but there will still be full totality in parts of New Hampshire. So they're probably already booking hotels in Pittsburgh.
I was hoping to put my house up on Airbnb, you know, I figure.
Yeah,
if it's going to be like it was.
You're
for
right.
The eclipse,
I mean, down here in Concord, it won't be full totality, but pretty close. And it will be.
I think if you're in driving distance, you're in pretty good shape.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, how did you experience this summer's eclipse, Macon? It was a big, big deal for you, I'm guessing.
It was a big deal. So also on sort of the more personal level, it was very exciting to here in D.C., walked out of our offices and down to the National Mall where all the museums are, and people were just pouring out and pouring onto the mall and just everybody together looking up at the sky. We had, I think, about 80% coverage here, which still was pretty cool, but we had colleagues all along the path because it went stretched from Oregon to South Carolina. Covering totality, including one of our correspondents who was with scientists in Wyoming and just watching what they did and what they were measuring. So as Dave said, bringing people together and making science accessible for anybody and everybody is a totally cool thing because, you know, you want people to be excited about science and its possibilities. And then on the research side, we actually did a series running up to it on 10 questions that the solar eclipse could answer, or maybe not the definitive answer, mm-hmm. but again, get us closer to answers. And one of the big ones, one of the big mysteries is the corona, which is the outer atmosphere of the sun, is millions of degrees, and it's much, much, much hotter than the surface of the sun. And when in a total solar eclipse, the sun itself is covered, so you get a really good look at the corona. Normally, you can't see it because the sun is too bright. So it provides a lot of opportunity to dig into that question. They don't have the answer yet, it will be exciting when we do finally get that answer.
Well, and again, a treasure trove of data, right, Macon? I mean, all those scientists flying at the exact same time, trying to catch measurements and pictures, and, you know, yet another dump of data, basically, for scientists to comb through.
Exactly, exactly. And they were looking not only at the sun, but impacts on some of the other close-in planets, and even, like, on Earth, what do animals do during an eclipse? So there was research, all different levels of research, and like you said, a lot of opportunity to really dig into some of these questions.
Go ahead, Dave.
That was something I heard from a number of people who were in totality, is the way all the birds would suddenly start making noise or stop making noise, depending on which species you had, when it suddenly became night. And it was quite an effect.
Right. That's interesting. So what did we learn from that about? Because I remember people speculating about how animals and other creatures would react.
Well, so the fun thing about science is it takes a while to analyze the data and come up with answers. So it is still in process. So maybe we'll get some of those answers in 2018.
Dave?
You know, the other thing I really like about the eclipse is it reminds us of this incredible coincidence that the apparent size of the moon and the apparent size of the sun as seen from the ground are exactly the same, even though they are, you know, orders of magnitude different in size and distance. And, of course, this is just a coincidence, I think, and it's not part of a design, but it just it always blows my mind that they are so exactly the same size. And if they weren't, the eclipse wouldn't be as exciting.
Well, before we move on from astronomy, other news, Macon, from this field of space science that you were excited about this year, even if it didn't make your top science stories of the year list?
There is always something fun going on in space, and it's you know, just one of those gee whiz areas. Actually, there was a recent story. You know, we've got this telescope out in space, the Kepler Space Telescope, that is known as the Exoplanet Hunter, and it's done a tremendous job. I think they've identified, you know, thousands of exoplanets. Recently, some scientists have teamed up with some folks at Google and used artificial intelligence to start combing through the data. And it looks like that is going to lead to possibly discovering many more exoplanets, because it can pick up on very subtle signals that maybe previous computer programs or just humans analyzing the data can't. They're basically looking for when a planet goes across the face of its star. They can see a blip and figure out that, yes, in fact, it is a planet. And so recently they used AI and found another solar system that, just like us, has eight planets. So they knew it had seven, and they found the eighth. So it is as far as we know, we are now not the only eight-planet solar system.
Never mind the Pluto controversy. We won't talk about that.
Well, let's leave poor Pluto out of this.
And of course, this gets the UFO people very excited, because it's sort of more kind of evidence that it's less unlikely that aliens might be visiting us, so they were all very excited.
Well, every time there's another exoplanet discovered, there is
a tiny,
quite seriously,
more
there's
of
more
a
possibility.
Instead
of
being
of life.
Virtually impossible, it's virtually impossible. But.
Well, we are talking about the top science stories of 2017 today in the Exchange, and in just a moment, we're going to turn from outer space to the human body. We'll find out more about that Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Institute. And also, we'll talk about gene editing. Macon's Science News has been looking at that. A couple of our listeners have jumped in on their top stories of the year, science stories. Fred says grid-scale battery storage in Australia gets his vote. And Jeffrey says it's the paper published showing a link between the GI tract bacteria and autism. What do you think the top science stories of the year are? Let's hear from you. This is The Exchange.
What makes New Hampshire, New Hampshire? Is it the people?
The Synchro sisters come marching into town like they've never seen a cloud in the sky.
Or is it the landscape?
We glide out beyond Willoughby Point until Chikoro Island, Church Island, as it's
perhaps it's a little of both. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this holiday season, consider supporting the station that connects you to the people and places unique to New Hampshire with a tax-deductible year-end gift to NHPR. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the top science stories of 2017, from outer space to the human body. Give us a call. What's your vote for the top story in science or tech this year? Or what questions and comments do you have about some of the stories we've been looking at? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour. Macon Morehouse joins us from D.C. She's news director for Science News, a daily website and biweekly magazine. And Dave Brooks is in studio, reporter for the Concord Monitor and blogger at Granite Geek. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, I wanted to start with a big science headline here in New Hampshire. This is the opening of what's called ARMI, the Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Institute. And I want to kick it off with a little clip from Dean Kamen, the founder of this, where he describes the future of this endeavor in the Manchester Mill Yard. This is, by the way, from an event at the White House last December, announcing that the Mill Yard had been chosen for this Department of Defense award. Let's hear Dean Kamen describe his big picture hopes for what this project might mean.
If you could give people a replacement kidney when they have end-stage renal failure, instead of treating them, the cost to the country right now of treating these people, just end-stage renal failure, is over $100 billion a year. It's 18% of all the money we spend on health care. You would wipe that cost out, and you would take 400,000 people out of the torture chambers that now they need to spend every other night in. That will be true for diabetes and heart disease and Alzheimer's. And one by one, as we go from finding ways to treat chronic conditions to using regenerative medicine to replace these organs, replace these cells, replace these tissues, we will dramatically reduce the crushing cost, we will dramatically increase the quality of life, and we will create a whole new industry.
Again, that's Dean Kamen, founder of what's called ARMI, the Advanced Regenerative Manufacturing Institute. So, Dave, just tell us how this fits into the ongoing science already of trying to create human tissues and organs. From what I've read, this is sort of the next big step.
Yeah, well, that's what it's aiming to kickstart, really. I think that's the way to think it. So there's two words in the name that are really important. And, I mean, we talk about regenerative, which is the cool science part of it. But it's the manufacturing and institute are the two important words. Because this, at least as it stands at the moment, this is not going to be a big area for basic, you know, wet lab science. They're not going to be trying to, you know, grow livers on the third floor of the Mill Yard or something like that. What they are trying to do is develop processes and materials like, say, sensors that you can better engineer tissues and tissue-related technologies and biofabrication. So there's lots of things that are happening in labs around the country, usually academic labs, that are terrific, you know, at lab scale, but how to actually make them work at the scale that is necessary to help the Army. So the Army, the DOD, the Department of Defense, kind of kicked this off. They gave, I believe it was $80 million, and they were talking about roughly $200 million in other money from corporations. Army obviously has a great interest in being able to quickly replace organs, even body parts, for our military fighters, and so that's sort of the incentive.
That's why DOD got in.
Injured
soldiers and come and get replacements.
Right. Exactly. There's no reason, and the reason Dean Kamen has been sort of the face of this project. So some people know him from the Segway, of course, but around here he's obviously known best for DECA R&D, which is the research and development company that he founded. Its essence is medical equipment that handles fluids, basically. That's how he originally made his money, and a lot of inventive stuff. But it's worked off of that. So he's already been working with a lot of medical equipment. And the other thing he's known for, of course, is for helping rejuvenate the Mill Yard. He's really one of the people that has turned the Mill Yard from these old semi-useless buildings into a really exciting place. And this is a really exciting thing, too, with UNH Manchester nearby, which is also going to be part of this. So he's probably the main reason that it came here instead of somewhere else.
It was competitive. Others wanted this. So
absolutely.
It's a really big deal.
It is a really big deal. It's a big deal for jobs. It's a big deal for when we're trying to lure all those 20-somethings that we want to move here. We can say, hey, look at this cool thing that happens in Manchester. It is a big deal. And I believe there will be a lot of engineers who come to work on it who will probably then sort of wander off and start their own companies. That's what you really want to have happen from something like this. And so it will sort of be seeding out technology and development, research and development in the state. But for the time being, it's an institute. It's going to be bringing together information that people have already started working on, combining different fields, getting them talking to each other, and seeing if they can develop processes and methods and equipment, and so that we can scale up this stuff quickly.
So it'll bring together people who are already working on creating a liver, creating human tissue, and then actually making the stuff there in Manchester?
I'm not sure there'll be a whole lot of making it in the Manchester. And that's part of what has to be decided. So I think more what will happen there is they will be developing processes and methods by which it could be made, and then there will be bids. And so the University of so-and-so, their big, huge wet lab will actually start doing it, or this major research hospital here and there, they'll actually be doing it. But they'll be doing it with methods and processes and discoveries that came out.
I see.
I believe that's the best way it's going to work.
So bringing medical researchers who've been working on this, putting them together with the sort of technical, innovative mind of Dean Kamen and his crew, and saying, how can we come together to create processes where we could create
again?
We
can actually do this at cost. We can actually do this at scale. You can start cranking out these things. Exactly.
Very interesting. Well, just last question. Go ahead, Macon. Did you want to jump in?
One thing I thought I would chime in on, you can really see the human impact of some of this research. As you guys were talking, it reminded me of a story from actually not too long ago where a boy with, they call them butterfly children, of a very fragile skin disease. He had lost 80% of his skin, and through gene therapy and creating new skin, basically new tissue that did not have the genetic defect that caused the fragile skin, they have been able to replace 80% of his skin, and this boy is now fine.
Wow.
So the possibilities that this research can lead to is pretty incredible and pretty life-changing.
Go ahead, Dave.
And replacing skin is actually one of the things that the military wants to do because of burns. Burns are a big issue.
Sure, that members of the military suffer.
Absolutely. Hmm. And that example is a good one, because it's one thing to have created a little bit of the skin in a petri dish that, you know, doesn't have the genetic component, and it would be fine. And it's another thing to create enough of it that you can actually put it on a kid and make a difference in his life, and you can do it quickly and easily and at cost. That's kind of the sort of the step that the ARMI is supposed to make.
Well, and that's an amazing story that you gave, Macon, and an encouraging one. And so I did want to ask you also, one of the top science news stories of the year was gene editing. Is that kind of what you're talking about with the skin example, or is that something different?
That's actually something different. So there's gene therapy, where they're actually providing replacement genes. So this disease, there are some problematic genes that cause the skin to be so fragile, and they were able to grow skin with all the genes that were needed to have healthy skin and replace it. Gene editing is basically going in and cutting DNA, replacing bits of it. It's been described as scissors, cut and paste kind of technology, and it actually goes in and tweaks the DNA versus just providing a replacement gene. It's a big deal, and one of the reasons why we picked it as one of our top stories this year is because they've started using it in viable human embryos. So that means it's getting much closer to clinical use, so similar to some of the gene therapy that we're seeing.
So gene editing at the embryonic stage, Macon.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a ton of research going on around gene editing. A lot of it is in animal models or in human cells in dishes. And they had also done some gene editing research in human embryos that were not viable, so could not grow into actual babies. But for the first time this year, they did research with viable human embryos to correct some blood disorder defect. These were not grown into, they were not grown to completion, but they're figuring out how to do it and how to do it safely and effectively. Because ideally, with gene editing, you will be able, if somebody inherits a disease, you'll be able to go in, fix the genetic defect, and that disease will be fixed for good. That person will never be able to pass it on to their children. And that's why there is so much excitement around this technology.
And ethical questions, I'm guessing. Anytime you talk about messing with human embryos, Macon.
There are ethical questions.
Absolutely.
And it's not just doing the work in human embryos. There are ethical questions about whether, you know, this can be used to cure disease, which is great, but there have been ethical questions raised about whether, you know, you can use this kind of technology to make somebody smarter or more athletic or whatever. You know, a lot of that may be pie in the sky because things, this is best for dealing with problems that involve just one gene, and a lot of diseases and a lot of things like intelligence, looks, whatever, are an interplay of different genes. Mm-hmm. And they interplay in ways that, you know, we don't even know a lot of the time. But it does raise a lot of very, very interesting questions. We actually just recently ran a blog post on whether once this technology is out there and in clinical use, like, should parents be obligated to gene edit their kids to get rid of diseases? And that's, I mean, that's kind of a
ethical minefield.
Yeah.
Well, especially if you can't afford it, right? So what does that bring up?
Who knows what kind of price tags there's going to be on these kind of things? We don't even know that yet.
Go ahead, Dave.
There are ethical and other questions that, you know, that don't involve humans with this as well. The one that came into effect this year is about editing mosquitoes so that they can't pass on certain diseases and releasing them in the wild.
Ooh, let's edit ticks so they can't pass on.
Well,
there
you go. That's exactly what a lot of people are talking about. There's actually a study going on, or going to be going on in Nantucket to release ticks. These are not gene edited ones, but they're trying to see if they can affect the population so they won't pass on the Lyme disease. But if you can go in and gene edit ticks so that Lyme disease won't develop them and they can't pass it on when they bite us, that would be awesome, and then release them into the wild. On the other hand, then once you've released them in the wild, maybe there's some unintended consequences
we
don't know about.
Sure,
so that's,
right.
That is going to be more and more of a problem, and particularly with a development called a gene drive, in which you can the genetic editing you do is not only is passed on and cannot be not passed on, so it can completely take over a population in a relatively short period of time. And in theory, this is theory, you could set up a gene drive and figure it out and completely wipe out a species of mosquito or something. But that's
which would not be good, because that mosquito has a part in our food chain.
Might not be good, and certainly
wouldn't be ecosystem.
It wouldn't be good if they started to do it to, you know, mammals or whatever. So the questions are many.
Yeah, go ahead, Macon. You wanted to finish up there.
Oh, I was actually going to segue into the gene therapy that we have been talking about,
because
we talked a little bit about cost, and you know, you are seeing the cost there. We talked a little bit about gene therapy with the butterfly disease, but the big news in the United States this year is that the FDA has approved actually now three. When we came out with our final list, it was only two, but three now gene therapy procedures, two for blood disorders and one just actually this week for a rare kind of blindness, which is offering, you know, hope to people. It's also very, very expensive, so it will be interesting to see where this goes. But the fact that gene therapy, you know, it's had a long history of clinical trials and some issues, but now it's actually approved for use.
All right. Well, gene therapy, gene editing, a kilonova, a lunar eclipse, exoplanets. We're covering the top science stories of 2017 today in The Exchange. Let's get your vote for the top science or tech headline of the year, or your questions and comments about some of the ones that we're talking about right now. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dave and Macon, let's go to our listeners again. And Jack is in Rye. Hi, Jack. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Thanks morning.
For taking my call.
Sure.
Good morning.
Yes. So anyway, I'm calling in regards to the coalescence of two neutron stars that were detected at the Twin LIGO detection centers in Washington and Louisiana. You know, I guess the idea that Einstein came up with field equations and triangulation from there in 1915 to the idea of black holes, then to the idea that they would come together, and then the idea that we could actually detect them and set up detectors. And since the 80s, you know, trying to tweak these two observatories to finally capture these waves, these new waves, distinctly different from the spectrum that the only spectrum we know, which is electromagnetism, to have a gravitational wave detector. Now, that was last year, so technically doesn't apply to this year. But the thing that's distinctly different this year is two neutron stars, as opposed to two black holes, required a different sensitivity. They're smaller, less massive. The wave that came through was even, you know, smaller and harder to detect. And the fact that they were able to do this, to me, is just incredible.
So that's what got you this year. Yeah, Jack, and we did talk about that. Go ahead, Dave.
And can I just say, I agree that it is incredible, and he described many ways why it is incredible and why being a fan of science and a science watcher is so much more interesting than being, you know, watching celebrities or trying to find ghosts or whatever. The, you know, reality is so much more interesting than all that other stuff. So there you go.
Well, yeah.
Well,
go ahead, Macon.
LIGO and Virgo, so the detectors that exist right now are actually shut down right now to be retooled to become even more sensitive, which is so, you know, who knows what else we're going to be able to detect. And there's also a couple of other gravitational wave detectors that are being built, one in India and one in Japan, I believe. So once we have all of those online, there's no telling what we're going to be able to pick up.
All right. Well, so that's Jack's pick for the top science story of 2016 and maybe 17 as well, as he said. And we definitely talked about that. And I know that was on Science News's top 10 list. Macon Morehouse is with us. She's news director for Science News, along with Dave Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor. We've been talking about some of the top science stories that our guests were watching. And we've also gotten some thoughts from our listeners, including Jack, who called in, and a couple emails earlier from listeners. We just got one from Rob, who says, I vote for the elimination of the Obama-era network neutrality laws as the top science and tech story of 2017. Rob says, unfortunately, this may be one of the many events that have long-term but currently unknown future repercussions. So coming up, we've got a couple more science-y stories, and then I do have one sort of tech geeky question to ask you, Dave Brooks. So we'll talk about that after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Thank you. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking back at the top science and tech stories of 2017, from outer space to the human body to technology and developments here in New Hampshire. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. What's your vote for the top science or tech headline of the year? Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or you can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Megan Morehouse, Dave Brooks, before we go back to our listeners, let's take another big, big topic right now, climate change and its impact on our oceans, our weather. Megan, this was a huge headline in 2017. Your magazine wrote, for example, that this year, for the first time, scientists have definitively linked climate change to extreme weather that the world saw in 2016. Who said that, Megan, right, and how can they be so sure?
Well, it's scientists who do a lot of climate research. It's a tough science because there is a lot of natural variability. We see a lot of things like warmer temperatures and all of that and think, oh, this must be climate change caused by humans, and that's one big distinction here. But it is a very difficult science to pin down. It's very difficult to say one specific event is caused by climate change. It's much easier to look long term over patterns of change. But there has been a group that has every year for the past, I believe, 7 years, looked at specific events and tried to determine whether any of those events can be attributed to human-caused climate change. And this year, for the first year, they were able to link 3 events from 2016. So, scientific research is always looking, back a little bit. And those were global record temperatures, a deadly heat wave in Asia, and a area of warm water in the Bering Sea, which had the nickname The Blob. The Blob. It's very exciting. And that was important because for a number of reasons. It messed up the food web, caused problems with the fish populations, which had repercussions with the seabird populations. It also changed weather patterns over California, which contributed to drought. And people are thinking, obviously, there have been a number of huge weather events this year, from the back-to-back-to-back hurricanes, the extra dry weather, wildfires. So it's a pretty good bet looking forward when they do the same report next year, that they will be able to link events again to human-caused climate change.
So how hard is it, Megan, to disentangle the role of climate change versus natural weather variability? You seem to be saying they have to be really careful about this.
It is very difficult because, variability, just like it sounds, it's a wide spectrum, and there is a chance that extreme events can happen naturally. So yes, it takes a lot of teasing out of the data to determine whether or not something is possible in the realm of nature, or whether the warming and the rise in CO2 and all the things that humans are contributing are in fact a player in this.
Well, as you said, Megan, the hurricanes that hit 3 parts of the U.S. this year generated a lot of talk about climate and its impact. And let's just hear how meteorologists were describing one of these hurricanes, Hurricane Harvey, as it approached Texas. This coverage is from Fox News meteorologist Janice Dean, and it's pretty typical of how this was being described.
A very strong winds, a tornado threat certainly through the evening and the overnight hours, and the fact that this storm is going to stall is going to make the impacts even more dire, life-threatening, catastrophic, disaster. Those are the types of terms that the National Hurricane Center is using.
Again, that's Janice Dean, meteorologist at Fox News, and we did see those dire impacts, but it sounds like from what you just said, Megan, that scientists right now would say we can't attribute these to climate change. We need to dig at it more.
And they are already digging into it. So at the same time that this report came out saying that these three events from 2016 were definitively connected to human-caused climate change, there were a number of reports looking at Hurricane Harvey's rainfall, which was, you know, just astronomical. And, you know, they are also pointing the finger at human-caused climate change. It's not perhaps 100% slam dunk at this moment in time, and there is more research going on. But again, I think you'll see when they come out with this report next year that some of these 2017 events will probably make the list of us having made them worse.
Made them worse, exactly. I mean, you know, the waters of the Caribbean are record warm, and the energy from hurricanes comes from warm water.
So the warmer the water, the bigger the hurricane.
You know, we've lit the fire, and then we're surprised that things are catching on fire. And obviously, here up here in New Hampshire, the October storm, October 29th and 30th, which was sort of the remnants of, and frankly, I've forgotten which hurricane it was. There were so many of them. Was it Juan, maybe, or something? Anyway, that came up here. It was a storm, and none of us thought it was, we all thought it was going to be a bad storm. 270,000 people without power. Maine, it was the most expensive storm they've ever had. Worse
That's
than
right.
any.
We had that huge wind outage.
Wind and rain, and it wasn't.
I think my kid's school was canceled, and it was not even winter.
There was no ice. It was weird. It was like a whole different kind of storm. And you talked about the rain from Harvey. We got, 6-7 inches of rain, which is a ton up here. In Harvey, they got 48 inches or more. So
pictures of people in Houston just kayaking down the street. Go ahead.
Concord had the warmest autumn on record, the 3 months for the meteorological autumn was the warmest ever. Portland, which shares our National Weather Service, they had their second warmest on record. UNH came out with a couple of pieces of research this year about the effect of climate change. And the effects are not what you would expect. So, for example, one of the things we've been talking about for many, many years in climate change is that there's going to be more extreme storms. There'll be more extreme drought, but when you have rain, you'll have heavier rain. And one of the things they had a study that heavier rains and intermittent rains will make it harder for rivers to clean up the water when there's runoff from the ground. So more pollutants will make it out to the estuaries and make it out to the ocean.
We actually talked about that on Monday in the exchange when we looked at
the estuary show. Exactly.
Yeah, the new report on estuaries.
And the one that really dismayed skiers like me is by the middle of the century, the estimates that the effects of human-caused climate change will be accelerating. Average snow days in New Hampshire, which currently is around 60, could fall to as low as 18.
I heard that on the radio, and I kind of went, wow. Now, snow days means days where there's snow on the ground or days when it snows?
No, days where it's snowing. So.
Yeah. I believe so. So right now we have about 60 days per year.
Well, actually, you know, now that you ask me that, that's a good question. I'm not absolutely certain because I don't think we have 60 days of snow.
Yeah, it seems
we
like
certainly
a lot.
Don't have 60 days. Maybe only 18 days of snow a year on the ground. Oh, that would be horrible. That'd be horrible.
So what did those UNH scientists say about, you know, this is going to happen or it might happen? I mean, I'm looking for a little hope here because 18 days doesn't sound very pretty.
Doesn't sound very New Hampshire-ish,
no.
Does it? No. No, this is not, it's not an absolute definite going to happen. These are, they're statistical models and mathematical models extrapolating from what is currently happening. Our understanding of how the climate and, you know, geography interact with each other is always growing, so the models can always change. So this is not a definite, and it's no reason for us to stop trying to, you know, reduce our impact, but it's something you should be ready for.
Well, making,
right. It's motivation. And, you know, the research also helps you start to try to figure out, okay, what can we do to mitigate the problems? So maybe that's where the hope is.
Sure. And the classic case for that for me is culverts, the most boring subject in the world. For 5-10 years now, road engineers in New Hampshire and many parts of the state have been saying we need to make bigger culverts because you get these more rainstorms and suddenly you're going to wash out roads. The culverts that worked for the kind of rain we had 20 years ago aren't going to work anymore. So that's the kind of mitigation that we need to be thinking about.
Well, and at this point, you know, we've heard a lot of headlines about melting polar ice caps and chunks of ice breaking off here and there. And Macon, your magazine had one of these stories on its top 10 list, a huge, huge Delaware-sized chunk of ice. I had a hard time wrapping my head around that. Breaking loose in Antarctica. What happened?
Well, so that actually also is a natural occurrence. One of the cool things here, though, is that we now have all sorts of monitoring equipment. So scientists were able to watch this as it was happening. And I think they were getting satellite updates every 6 days, so you could actually see the crack growing. You know, people were very interested because, one, it's big, and two, you know, there is this whole climate change discussion, even though, again, this is a natural event, and how much climate change had to do with the ice shelf cracking is, you know, up for debate. But, you know, we were able to watch it practically in real time happening. And now there is an unprecedented opportunity to get down to Antarctica and see, do all kinds of science, like see what if anything lived under that ice, because as soon as sunlight hits it, the whole ecosystem starts to change, so they're going to be able to get there practically before that starts happening. They're going to be able to map the seafloor there. They're going to be able to look at the rest of the ice shelf and see how it reacts to the different pressures on it now, which can help sort of predict the future and what is going to happen with the ice shelf, and whether we're going to see more huge icebergs.
Well, and that's kind of the theme that I'm getting from both of you guys today, that if we could characterize 2017 at all in terms of science, it seems like making huge treasure troves of data for scientists, whether from the kilonova, whether from the solar eclipse, and whether from this giant piece of ice breaking loose in Antarctica. As you said, this is a huge area that all of a sudden scientists can look at what is down there and watch biological effects happen, because all of a sudden, you know, let there be light, right, in this area that's been covered by ice for so long. So
exactly, there are a lot of opportunities, and you know, science is sometimes all about grabbing those opportunities and seeing, you know, seeing where the science takes you.
Wow, interesting. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. A couple of our listeners have chimed in with their votes for the top science and tech stories of the year. We've got a couple more minutes to take your thoughts on that. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. A couple more quickies that I wanted to get to with both of you. And Dave, to you, this is more of a tech story than a science story, but you've written that New Hampshire has become a Bitcoin hotbed. Now, we've done some shows on this, but just for folks who have no idea what Bitcoin is, remind us.
All right. So Bitcoin is a cyber currency. So it acts like money, but it's not established by any government or any central institution. And it's basically created by crunching through some not very hard, but quite long mathematical formulas. And people can trade it online and use it like currency. And it was kind of this interesting novelty for a couple of years. And as everybody has heard, in the last 6 months, it has gone bananas. And the value of Bitcoin, if you turned it into dollars, has, I don't know, it's over $20,000 per Bitcoin. It's gone up by staggering percentages. I heard there was a hedge fund that got into Bitcoin early, and its total value and growth has been 25,000%.
At this moment.
At this moment. Tomorrow. And, you know, and while we're talking, it's gone up 10%. Who knows? This is of interest in New Hampshire in particular because of our libertarian and the Free State Project, which came here. We have a fairly strong libertarian presence in the state, and libertarians have long been fans of Bitcoin. They like it because it's, you know, money without government, and libertarians love to get rid of government. So they've embraced it. So my suspicion is that the per capita ownership of Bitcoin in New Hampshire is actually quite high, which means there's all this wealth being generated, and it's being generated within a particular certain part of the of society. It'll be interesting to see what happens if all of a sudden, you know, the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire is the wealthiest party in the state.
You wrote, I think, Dave, it was you who wrote that some Bitcoin vending machines are actually, you know, like ATMs are actually
not quite ATMs. So they don't give you cash back, but you can turn cash into Bitcoin. And there's a couple of them. There's one of them in Concord, Navarre. There's several of them in the state. We probably have the highest per capita Bitcoin ATM rate in the country, perhaps, again, because of the free staters who are so interested in it. The enormous growth in the value of Bitcoin has rendered it useless as a currency because nobody's going to spend it. I mean, you've heard of hyperinflation. What Bitcoin is hyperdeflation, is that it's growing in value so fast that you're not going to spend it because that'd be crazy because it'll be worth twice as much tomorrow. So why would you?
But it might not be.
Yeah,
I'm more of a cautious financial type. I think you're probably getting that.
I don't think the Bitcoin believers think it's going to not be. They're talking about $100,000. Yeah, who knows? So it's not a currency right now. It is a speculative. It's like, you know, gold. I don't know what it is like. There's nothing that has been like it.
Well, Macon, lastly to you, we've been talking about the top science stories of the year. And again, we've put a link on our website to Science News's picks for the top 10 science stories of the year. But what science or tech stories, Macon, did you just love to cover this year, even if they weren't a big, big deal or a huge discovery? What did you just like?
You know, I like fossils. And we actually had a recent story on another treasure trove. It was a discovery of something like 200 pterosaur eggs. And these were ancient flying reptiles. And prior to that, they'd only found, you know, one here, one there. And with 200 and some with the embryos still inside, they're starting to be able to figure out sort of the life and times of the pterosaur.
Wow.
So it's really cool when science can go back and take you to a place that you'll never be able to see, but it can recreate it for you.
Wow. So still embryos in these fossilized
eggs. There were some. Yep.
That's amazing. All right. So from fossils to exoplanets to Bitcoin, we covered a lot this hour. Thank you both very much. And Happy New Year. Maybe we can do this again and look at the top science stories of 2018. But for now, Macon Morehouse, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
That's Macon Morehouse, News Director for Science News. It's a daily website and biweekly magazine. Dave Brooks, always good to see you.
Always a delight to be away from my typewriter and come here to the microphones.
Dave Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor and blogger at Granite Geek. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.